Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine, you're just doing chores, you're sweeping the floor of this abandoned Victorian manor, and the dust you kick up doesn't settle.
Right, it just hangs there.
Yeah, it twists into the shape of a serpent. And then you look over at this forgotten, ragged teddy bear in the corner, and it stands up, draws a tiny winter sword, and literally runs out of the room.
It's completely wild.
It is. And today, we are tracking the exact moment an ordinary afternoon of chores completely shatters into an ancient, magical Cold War. We're doing a deep dive into a really fascinating narrative log from the modern fantasy universe of Mirari.
Set in Markwart Manor, right?
Exactly. This damaged, dusty, just absolutely battered estate.
And our mission today is really to map that specific transition. Because chores are supposed to be grounding, you know, you sweep, you dust, you organize. It's a very predictable interaction with the physical world.
Right, you're just cleaning.
Exactly. But when that physical world violently breaks its own rules, the illusion of safety just collapses. So we are going to look at how hidden surveillance, magical forensics, and this staggering case of reincarnated identity just systematically dismantle the everyday reality of these teenagers.
The juxtaposition in the source material is just, it's striking. We have Agatha, who is an older teen, and Alice, a young girl, and she's carrying this beloved stuffed unicorn named Lord Mel.
Oh, Lord Mel.
Yeah, keep him in mind. So they are in Harcourt Manor, which is so battered by treasure hunters that there are literal holes smashed into the walls. And they decide to clean out this abandoned upstairs bedroom that belonged to a woman named Anastasia
It's
Harcourt.
just a normal afternoon.
Right, taking down heavy tapestry curtains armed with a feather duster. It feels so mundane, but it's not.
No, because the physical environment is littered with these artifacts that kind of bridge the mundane and the magical. I mean, the girls find a wardrobe full of vintage fashion, a toy box locked with a tiny heart-shaped key, and oh, the kaleidoscope.
The one that's disguised as a brass telescope.
Yes. These items set a precedent right away. Like, nothing in this room is exactly what it appears to be on the surface.
And that becomes literal very quickly.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned, Alice is dusting, and the dust clouds don't just hang in the air. They form these serpentine, ghostly wisps.
Which is already creepy enough.
But then she spots something at the window, a slit eye, like a cat or a lizard, just staring in at them from the upper corner of the glass.
And they're on the second floor.
Exactly. The physics of a lizard clinging to a second-story window pane instantly signals that they are under surveillance. Someone is watching them.
Well, surveillance requires an observer. And sometimes, you know, the observer is already inside the room.
Oh, man.
The inciting incident of this whole sequence happens when Alice opens that toy box with the heart-shaped key. She pulls out this ragged stuffed bear. Its head is crudely sewn back on, and it's clutching a roughly carved wooden sword.
Right, and she names it Sir Bruin Bear.
Yeah, she names it, sets it down, and just turns her back for a second. And without a sound, the bear stands up on its little felt feet and runs out the door.
See, my immediate thought reading this was, why a ragged teddy bear? I mean, it's like finding out Woody from Toy Story is real, but instead of being a friendly cowboy, he's a magically animated guardian or a spy.
Right, a covert operative.
Yeah. But if you possess the magical capability to enchant a spy, why not inhabit something durable, like a bronze statue or a suit of armor, or at least a toy that isn't falling apart? Choosing a damaged stuffed animal seems like a terrible tactical disadvantage.
You'd think so, but I actually look at it as the ultimate form of magical camouflage.
Oh, interesting. How so?
Well, in intelligence gathering, the best spy is the one that registers as background noise. If you animate a bronze statue, its movement causes instant panic.
True. A walking statue is hard to miss.
And if you enchant a weapon, it draws attention. But in a sprawling house that has seen generations of children, a discarded broken toy is practically invisible.
It's just clutter.
Exactly. It is the perfect vessel to observe a household without ever triggering an alarm. It totally subverts the psychology of childhood comfort to create an undetectable sleeper agent.
A sleeper agent made of felt. That is so unsettling, and it completely changes the context of finding it a few minutes later.
Right, when they track it down.
Yeah, they chase the bear and find it sitting motionless in another room. But it has changed. It is now wearing this mysterious brass medallion on a ribbon around its neck.
The heraldic symbol.
Yes, it has a sword over a wreath of four flowers, flanked by two four-pointed stars.
Which is a huge geopolitical breadcrumb in this universe. The sword implies martial duty or conflict, while the flowers and stars indicate alliances or specific factions.
So it's wearing a uniform, basically.
Exactly. And Agatha and Alice, they attempt to reverse engineer the magic right there. Alice swings the medallion like a hypnotist pendulum in front of Kuon, this greyhound dog they have with them.
Which only makes the poor dog dizzy.
Right. And then she even ties it around her unicorn doll, Lord Mel, expecting some kind of activation sequence.
But nothing happens, which forces them to confront a pretty terrifying reality. Finding an animated bear is a shock to the system, obviously, but realizing why it moved and why there was an eye at the window means they're actively being monitored.
They're a target.
Exactly. So instead of fleeing the house, which I probably would have done, they pivot to investigation. They start conducting magical forensics to track their stalkers.
But tracking the untrackable requires a very different kind of technology, and this brings us back to Kuon.
The dog.
Right. Kuon is technically a greyhound, but the text establishes pretty early that he possesses a supernatural sense of smell and cognitive understanding way beyond a normal canine.
Yeah, he's definitely not a normal pet.
Not at all. Agatha spots these widespread tracks near a smashed hole in the wall, tracks that are way too big for that tiny lizard at the window, so they instantly know they have multiple intruders.
And the interrogation technique Alice uses on this dog is just, it's brilliant. She essentially builds a magical suspect lineup out of dust.
It's so smart.
She gets down on the floor and draws a diagram of the four seasons, like a sun for summer, a leaf for fall, a snowflake for winter, and a flower for spring. Then she writes the abbreviations for the months under each symbol.
She literally maps out the entire political ecosystem of Murari right there on the floorboards.
Because the magical factions are organized into houses aligned with months and seasons.
Exactly. So Alice walks Kuon through the summer months, pointing at the symbols, and when her finger taps August, Kuon barks and wags his tail.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so through a canine medium, a child confirms that the lizard spy at the window belongs to House August.
But the dog keeps going. He tracks a distinct scent from the hole in the wall, down the hallway, into the master bedroom, and back out.
Right, tracing a whole patrol route.
Yeah. So Alice shows him the brass medallion from the bear, asking if any houses use it. And Kuon points them to the spring quarter, specifically House April.
And we have to analyze the historical overlap there. Agatha pieces together that the former inhabitant of this room, Anastasia Harcourt, was likely connected to House April.
So the surveillance isn't random at all.
Not even a little. The history of the physical manor is deeply, deeply intertwined with the modern-day spies infiltrating it.
So let's just tally the threats for a second. What does this all mean for them? Agatha realizes they have tracks from an unknown large creature, a reptilian spy from House August, a historical and active link to House April via the bear, and earlier in the source material, they interacted with a wolf entity known as Lord December.
That is four distinct, powerful factions sniffing around one dusty manor.
The kids are standing at ground zero of a magical Cold War. How does this realization escalate the stakes for them?
Well, the stakes have escalated from simply surviving a haunted house to navigating complex geopolitical espionage. Every creak of the floorboards could belong to a different political entity with completely competing agendas.
It's sheer paranoia.
Absolutely. The perimeter has been breached, so their natural instinct is to retreat, to go find their friends and consolidate their group.
Which makes the next sequence so deeply unsettling. Because Agatha sneaks downstairs to the kitchen, seeking sanctuary, right? She expects to find her missing friends, Tom and Simon.
And she does find them.
She does. But the threat isn't just outside the house anymore. It has already infiltrated their inner circle. It has literally overwritten her friend's mind. Tom is sitting at the kitchen table, calmly shuffling a deck of cards, but he is completely transformed.
And the physical transformation is jarring, but it is merely a symptom of a massive psychological shift.
It's wild. He's traded his usual jeans and t-shirt for this billowy poet shirt, a leather vest, sturdy leather boots buckled up the side, and a crisscross leather belt with an empty sword frog.
And the beret.
Oh, right. His hair is combed back beneath the beret. But it's his vocabulary and his posture that are truly alien. He introduces himself to his own friends as Sir Thomas Winthrop, Lord Explorer of Murari and co-founder of the Golden Hawks.
The mechanics of reincarnation in the Murari universe are just fascinating here. Tom claims his previous life has awakened.
Just like that.
Yeah. He explains that he spent time with Lord December, that winter wolf entity we mentioned, and went to a library made of ice. He read the histories of the Golden Hawks, saw an old photograph of himself, and the memories simply flooded back.
It's not like Tom just read a convincing history book, though. I look at it like a computer hard drive. Lord December essentially partitioned Tom's brain, booting up an ancient operating system that completely overwrites his teenager personality with a seasoned general's code.
That's a great way to put it.
He calls Agatha, by a nickname, Redmayne. He acts with the weariness of a veteran.
And the psychological weight of that dual existence has to be immense. Thomas claims that the moment he admitted he was this ancient knight, everything felt normal. He felt home.
But for the people around him,
it's horrifying. They are looking at their friend, but speaking to a stronger who just happens to be wearing his face.
And Thomas immediately applies this ancient perspective to the present situation. He turns his attention to little Alice and her stuffed unicorn, Lord Mel.
This part gave me chills.
Right. He starts probing Alice about her earliest memories, and he brings up this highly specific, tragic piece of Merari royal history. He says the current king of Merari had a son who died in an accident and a daughter who died just after birth.
He correlates that historical tragedy directly with the physical artifact in the room, because Alice reveals that the tag on her doll read, "For Alice, from your father, a faithful protector always."
Wait, so he's connecting her?
Yes. Thomas is drawing a direct line between the sweet little girl and the reincarnated deceased princess of Merari. He is implying her stuffed unicorn is a magically bound royal guardian.
Oh, wow. This completely recontextualizes the entire first segment with the teddy bear. These items aren't just enchanted toys. They are ancient artifacts of a past life tied to a tragic royal lineage just waiting for their dormant owners to wake up.
They are anchors to another reality.
But wait, here's where it gets really interesting. If you are Agatha in this situation, you have to be deeply skeptical. A giant talking wolf takes your teenage friend away for a few days, and he comes back claiming to be an ancient lord. My first thought is magical brainwashing. Like, is he actually a reincarnated knight, or has he just been manipulated?
And Agatha voices that exact suspicion. She represents the anchor to mundane reality here. She crosses her arms and actively demands to check him for magical influence.
She wants to do an exorcism?
Yes. She wants to perform an exorcism to get the old Tom back. She completely refuses to accept that a teenager's identity can simply be deleted by a ghost.
And Thomas's response to her is honestly heartbreaking. He says nobody ever said being a ghost would be easy.
Yeah, that line hits hard.
He hasn't lost his recent memories. He remembers rescuing Simon and tracking the wolf. But those recent teenage memories are now just a thin layer of paint over centuries of war, politics, and duty.
It changes his whole demeanor.
Exactly. He even hugs Eleanor, thanking her for keeping the dream alive, which Agatha notes is completely out of character for the awkward teenager Tom used to be.
But while the group is paralyzed by this interpersonal crisis, you know, debating the validity of Tom's soul, the political machinery of Merari forces their hand. The outside world refuses to wait for them to process their trauma.
No, it barges right in. And the arrival of the messenger is just a brilliant piece of cinematic tension. Kuan the dog starts barking wildly at the kitchen window.
Because of the falcon.
Right. Sitting on the ledge is this noble peregrine falcon. It has patterned plumage of grays, browns, and tans, and it's fixing the room with a sharp yellow eye. And strapped to its leg is a hollowed bone scroll case.
The presence of the falcon immediately stress tests the factional loyalties within the room. This isn't a neutral postal worker. The messenger animals in Merari are deeply embedded in the political hostilities of their respective houses.
Yeah, Thomas puts on heavy chainmail metalworking gloves.
Yeah.
Just to invite the falcon inside. But the moment Eleanor steps forward to help untie the tiny strings of the scroll case, the bird loses its mind.
It goes on the attack.
It spreads its wings, snaps its beak, and raises its hackles, showing pure aggression toward her.
And the mechanism behind that aggression requires some context. Eleanor is secretly aligned with House October. The factional rivalries of Merari are so entrenched that a royal falcon can literally smell the political affiliation on a teenager and reacts to her as an enemy combatant.
That is insane. So Thomas finally gets the bone case open and slides out a thin parchment. It is sealed in wax with a crest of a leaping buck. It is addressed formally to Her Highness, Princess Angel.
The tension in the room is just suffocating at this point.
Suffocating. Alice unrolls it, reads it aloud, and it says, and I quote, "Rebecca says hi, and she wants her book back."
The cognitive dissonance of that message is staggering.
It's like getting a royal decree delivered by a dragon sealed in gold, and it just says, "Hey, did you borrow my stapler?"
That's exactly what it's like. You have a militarized royal beast delivering a wax-sealed parchment, and the text reads like a middle school text message.
It is completely absurd, but Agatha, who is rapidly adapting to this paranoid environment, immediately suspects a trap. She asks if Rebecca's parents have heard from her. Eleanor admits they've received phone calls.
But Thomas points out a glaring flaw in that logic.
Right. There are no telephones in the realm of Murari.
The absurdity of the note is a smokescreen. Rebecca is currently staying with House October. House October is faking phone calls to the human world to keep Rebecca's parents complacent.
Oh, wow.
The mundane request for a borrowed book is just the cover. The true message is the delivery system itself.
Sending a royal falcon that explicitly hates House October to deliver a note from a girl held by House October. It's a flex.
It is absolute psychological warfare.
It tells Thomas and the group, basically, we have her, we know where you are, and we can reach you whenever we want.
And it forces Thomas to drop the Gentle Reunion Act and fully assume the role of a military commander. The falcon gets impatient, hops onto Alice's shoulder, and its talons scratch her, leaving a drop of blood on her dress.
Which upsets Alice, understandably.
Yeah, she excuses herself to the bathroom, and the moment the child leaves the room, the atmosphere turns lethal.
Thomas locks onto Eleanor. He knows she has ties to House October, the faction currently holding Rebecca.
He doesn't ask for her help. He tests her absolute loyalty.
He forces Eleanor to recite the original tenets of the Golden Hawks. To serve the land and the throne, not one house alone. Why does this matter so much?
Because the Golden Hawks are a historical order designed to be nonpartisan. By forcing her to recite the oath, Thomas is legally and magically binding her. He is stripping away her allegiance to Lord October and forcing her to commit to the broader survival of Murari.
He explicitly warns her that the future is going to be incredibly dangerous and they must be ready.
He is securing assets for a coming war. It is the definitive end of their childhood. They aren't kids playing make-believe in an abandoned house anymore. They are drafted soldiers in a multidimensional conflict.
That is so heavy. The source material just masterfully intertwined the universal experience of growing up with the literal mechanics of reincarnation and espionage.
It really does. The transition from childhood to adulthood always involves a loss of innocence and the assumption of heavy responsibilities. Murari simply literalizes that process by overwriting a teenager's mind with the memories of a weary night.
It reframes the concept of childhood imagination entirely. We all had complex games we played, imaginary friends we held extensive conversations with, old toys we imbued with personalities before eventually packing them away in a dark closet.
And the unsettling proposition of this narrative is that those games might not be imagination at all. What if the complex rules of a childhood game are actually fragmented, bleeding memories of a past life?
Right. What if the toy you talked to was actually a vessel you subconsciously enchanted?
It makes you look at your old stuff differently.
Definitely. Imagine opening an old box in your parents' attic, finding a ragged teddy bear, and realizing it isn't waiting to be played with. It is a sleeper agent waiting for orders. The most mundane objects in your home suddenly become artifacts of a forgotten war.
The controlled environment of everyday life is permanently shattered.
It really is. I want to leave you with this final thought to mull over. If the hard drive of your mind was suddenly partitioned and you were forced to remember a past life filled with duty, ancient wars, and unbreakable oaths, would you be able to hold on to the person you are right now?
That is the big question.
Or would the sheer crushing weight of who you used to be completely overwrite you? Would the present you survive the past you? Think about that the next time you look at a childhood photo. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.